On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. For a fee, today's class does include continuing education units. If you would like to receive two CEUs for this training, please register and pay through ITRC's Wild Apricot portal. I'll put that link in the chat here in just a moment if you are interested. I'm going to go over a few housekeeping rules so that you can make the most out of today's training as an active participant. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. This guidance was produced by ITRC in 2019. We cannot cover all the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance document. So please visit the website and take a look at it if you have not already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you work on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some housekeeping rules for today. I'm sure some of you are familiar with these. Our training is scheduled for 2 hours and 15 minutes. This training is recorded and will be available on demand for those not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of their slides as we move through the session. If you would like to control your own slides, the PowerPoint presentation is available in PDF format on the CLUIN training page that brought you here today. In Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window where you can ask questions or report any technical issues that you have during the session. We will have two Q&A breaks during the training today, one about halfway through and then one at the end of the session. Feel free to type in any questions that you have for our trainers at any point, and we will answer as many as we can live. Those we don't have the time to get to, our trainers will answer in the Q&A window via chat. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you'll be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support any documentation for continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you'll be able to certify that you participated, and once you do so, a certificate will be issued to you via email. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance Team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they've also dedicated many hours to developing this guidance document, and a special thank you to them for participating today. With that, I'm going to hand it off to Chris, our first trainer, for our introduction.
All right. Thank you, Devin. And thank you all for attending this webinar. Could you open the poll? Yep, you got it open already. All right. Have you ever had a remedy not meet design expectations? This slide gives you, well, you can't see it because the poll question's up, but that's all right. Our splash page is basically when you go to this document on the web, this is the first page you come to. As with all ITRC documents produced in the last 5 years, they're all web-based to allow for easier access, linking references, tables, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry, just getting used to the old Zoom here. Okay, you are in the right spot for the next 2.5 hours if you said yes to the poll question. If not, there are a handful of us who contributed to this guidance that would like to know your secret. As our first slide implies, this webinar is aimed for your site involving injection of amendments at the correct doses for the in situ remediation of contaminant mass and how to optimize any phase of that process. Although the subject of in situ remediation is far from new, everyone, even the ones who said no to the poll question, have encountered challenges when it comes to in situ remediation. The problem we are facing is failing to achieve the expected objectives or performances of in situ injection remedies and encountering unknown variables that impact effectiveness. So I want you to be thinking right now of your own examples, and then Rich will give you some in the next segment. So during the generation of this document, production, our team did a survey of state regulators across the US for remediation proposals they received. And about 40% deemed the first submittal as incomplete. Why? Well, it hinged around an incomplete conceptual site model, which in turn led, for example, to inadequate amendment placement or choosing the wrong delivery for the site geology. Okay, what is optimization? Optimization is the effort at any cleanup phase to identify and implement actions that improve effectiveness and cost efficiency of that phase. Optimization in in-situ remediation is the management of risks and uncertainties through sound science and engineering during different stages of in-situ remedy planning and implementation. I emphasize these words because they are the theme of this course and of this document. I hope you can see that this webinar and the document intend to promote the best practices for the benefit of all, being the regulatory agencies, the responsible parties, you, the consultants, and the public. I want you all to think of this document and its tables and fact sheets as an optimization toolbox. On the left side is your first introduction to the layout of this guidance. On the right are those tools we are going to use to optimize the remedial process. We want to make it clear that we wrote this document for remediation managers, responsible parties, and regulators. However, we did not write this document as a remediation 101. You need to be familiar with the principles of in situ remediation and preparation of a CSM. We also wrote this for state regulators to identify potential shortcomings in remediation plans and to ask specific questions of the consultants and responsible parties. Now, perhaps you've written a good CSM, you feel pretty confident about your remedy selection, but you want to make sure there are no data gaps or that your amendments will work with a selected delivery method. What, as I asked you before, what are the technical challenges you are encountering with an existing remedy or its implementation, or for those, you know, perhaps at the very beginning stages of a remedial selection, you are, let's think about a few things here. Are we having higher concentrations after injections compared to baseline? Or is there no indication of a change after an amendment injection? Do you have insufficient amendment distribution and contact at your site? In other words, is your amendment daylighting? Are you getting contact? Or are you using the vendor's dosing default values instead of data from your CSM? With these challenges in mind, let's head to table 1-1 in Appendix B of the guidance. This slide is a snapshot of the commonly encountered issues associated with remedial design characterization. Now, there are two other tables in this section, them being commonly encountered issues with amendment dose and delivery, and commonly encountered issues with field implementation. Please don't try to read the gray print, but do pay attention to the column headings. So, as you identify your lithology and contaminant in the left two columns, you can read the common challenges in the center, lessons learned, and then you get the answers via the fourth column, which contains links to the content within the text, links to view a particular delivery or amendment fact sheet, and links to other documents, including applicable ITRC guidance as shown here. I want you to think of this table as your customized table of contents, tailored to your particular site conditions or the challenges you are facing. Now, these are the objectives of this internet-based training sessions. So take a look at these five bullet points and think about them as I move through these introductory slides. So as you see from the last slide, the presentation roadmap introduces the three major elements of our key graphic on the left. If you consider the top and bottom boxes as the bread of a sandwich, the lettuce, tomato, and meat of the middle three correlate to the order of the document is written in. So Rich DeRozier is going to take care of remedial design and characterization. Jaydeep is going to cover the amendment dose and delivery design. And then Elizabeth is going to talk about implementation, monitoring, and interpretation. Then I will circle back and cover stakeholder and regulatory considerations. This flowchart is likely similar to most of you because it is the CERCLA process of remediating sites and taking them to closure, which is similar to the RCRA process for petroleum impacted sites. But the common goal of both is what? Is to clean up sites, correct? As we developed this guidance, we realized the linear approach to the left gave us no flexibility. Notice the arrows are all just one directional. So our key graphic was born. By now you've gotten a good hint of the three main elements of our document: remedial design characterization, the design wheel with amendment dose and delivery, and implementation, monitoring, and interpretation. We discovered that optimization was the outcome of better characterizing our subsurface conditions, improving the CSM, performing bench tests and pilot studies, making mistakes, and then going back to an earlier step, i.e. the double-headed arrows. We realized the most flexible approach had to be iterative. So we're not throwing away the graphic to the left. We are merely augmenting it by placing our key graphic right in this area here. And guess what? The iterative approach is nothing new. Our key graphic is an augmentation of the ITRC's 2011 Dean Apple Site Strategy Guidance document on the left. So this basically fits the beige here is fitting right into the 2011 IDSS. The true nature of in situ remediation is iterative. The iterative, interactive approach lets the CSM become adaptable to new technologies and to new contaminants. The team further augmented the key graphic with what we call the optimization staircase to the right of the key graphic, wherein the process of implementing, monitoring, and optimization takes place during the bench test and pilot test phases of design phase in section 3, and again during the actual full-scale implementation in the blue hexagon. Do you see the opportunities for optimization where in the feedback loops of the optimization staircase take you back to the miniature design wheels, for instance, if monitoring and implementation didn't work? Okay, We're now going to get into our first hexagon, which is remedial design characterization with Rich DeRozier of GZA Geoenvironmental. Rich?
Thank you, Chris, and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this program. I think it's one of the good programs that ITRC has put out, especially related to injections. And for those of you who have done a number of injections and those who are learning to do injections, there's a lot of information that you can glean from today's course. So as Chris mentioned, I'm going to be talking about remedial design characterization. And we've done a lot of that when it comes to, let's see, I got to take control here. Devin, I don't seem to have control. Could you advance the slide, please?
Yep, there you go.
All right, thank you. So what is RDC, remedial design characterization? We've all done out and we've characterized sites. We've done phase one characterization, phase two delineation, nature and extent. But this is really focusing on a collection of additional data above and beyond general site characterization, necessary to develop a sufficient detail conceptual site model. So if you think about your characterization, you've gone out to look at let's say a groundwater plume. And in that plume, you've defined the nature and extent. So the horizontal and the vertical. But this is really designed to come in and look at the data that you need to design a remedy in the site specific. So this really enables you to design the basis for a successful in situ remedy. So you've got the data that is broad, and now we're really focusing in on the area itself. Could you advance the next slide, please? So why do it? So that's always a good question. I've had that a number of times from our clients, our staff. Why do we need to go out and do more characterization? We found that as a group that when in situ remedies fails or produces less than optimal outcomes, it's really often due to the lack of detailed data or an insufficiently developed conceptual site model. So if you really think about this on the big picture, it really goes back into what you know and what you don't know. So in many cases, we're putting in a small number of borings into a very large aquifer, and we probably don't know more than what we do know. So the success of an in-situ remedy is directly related to the understanding of the site and its subsurface conditions. Next slide, please. So here's a conceptual model that we have on a couple of slides that we're going to go through. So this might be a site that's typical. Maybe we finished the phase three program and we've put in a report that said we really understand the nature of the contamination. And so here we have an alluvium formation that we install seven borings to about 140 feet. The overall length, the x-axis, is about 3,500 feet, and we log these every 5 feet. So we're thinking about going in with an auger, doing split spoon samples every 5 feet. We have a good picture, at least we think we do. Next slide, please. So the next level of impact is we've gone on, we've collected more data. So instead of having seven borings, we have 40 borings over the same 3,500-foot alignment. The soils are still logged every 5 feet in the vadose zone, but once we got down into the saturated zone, they were logged continuously. So this is a whole lot different picture than what we had on the previous image, and we start seeing there's a lot more complexity to the subsurface conditions than perhaps we thought. Next slide. And now we have even more borings. 60 borings over the same 3,500-foot length. You know, all the soil has been logged continuously. And now we have this cross-section that has a lot of complexities where we're seeing low permeable materials, we're seeing higher permeable materials, we're seeing perched locations for groundwater, we're seeing variabilities in the groundwater levels, we're seeing a lot more information. So if we just think about that first slide and we were going to go in and do some injections, you can sort of see that, you know, the injection program might vary based upon this data set versus the previous data set. And a lot of times we can do this with soil borings with continuous samplings. We can also do it with things like membrane interface probes if we're looking at things like chlorinated solvents or other techniques that be able to give you a much higher resolution. So with the higher resolution, we learn a lot more information. Next slide, please. So what do we really need to know? Well, we need to know the geology, you know, and that's really going to define those properties of the flow regime. How is groundwater flowing through the geology itself? The hydrogeology, well, that's really going to influence the flow in the nature and transport of the contaminant. The geochemistry, well, if we're thinking about doing a injection program, electron acceptors become very important because there may be competitors in the groundwater of materials that we're going to amend to the aquifer. And maybe we need to know a little bit more about metals because they might be mobilized. And then something about the microbial in terms of degradation potential. Next slide, please. So here's one that I think is a really key graphic that I think if you get a couple points out today, this would be one that they carry away with. So what is the value of these additional investigations? So why do we want to spend more money to characterize when you could spend more money on cleanup? I think we have a lot of clients that might agree with that statement. But in reality, it's a false narrative. Because if you look at when you think about an in-situ remedy failing, it's often due to the lack of detailed data or insufficient conceptual site model. So let's look at this graphic itself. So we have the preliminary investigations, phase one, phase two, the blue line and the red line both overlap each other. You got site characterization. So you've done the RDC. So now you have the blue line. So you can sort of see the blue line is higher than the red line. So you've spent more money than upfront in order to learn more about the complexity of the subsurface that you have. And then as you go out in the future, your remedy becomes cheaper in the long run than the remedy without the upfront characterization. So I think this slide really shows you that you've spent a little bit more money, but your remedy becomes more effective, is cheaper, and is a shorter time frame. And I'll get into that in a second. Next slide, please. So here's a second concept in terms of a case study where there was a 20-acre site in California in the Central Valley. Was impacted both the soils and groundwater with VOCs. It's in a floodplain deposits. And the target treatment zone are the sand lenses that are several feet thick and approximately 15 feet below grade. So the initial remedy was, like many cases, you have a tight redevelopment timeframe. And, you know, basically the selection was to go out and do enhanced in situ bioremediation with sodium lactate. So we've all done these different kinds of studies and we have experience from the previous site. But I think what we're going to identify here is that previous sites may not necessarily be the site you have at hand. Next slide, please. So we have the good, the bad, and the ugly, I suppose. The good was that the geology was well characterized. The injections were properly performed within the sand intervals. So we were able to target the zones that we wanted to, and we knew where the zones were. The bad news is that the hydraulic conductivity wasn't fully evaluated. The injection tests not fully performed. Geochemical parameters not used to assess the viability of the amendment that we're using, no treatability testing up front. The choice of substrate and dosin was based upon similar sites. Microbial studies were not performed and the upgradient source was not assessed or removed. So we have a lot more on the bad than we do the good. The next slide, please. So if you could pop up the poll question while I go through this. So the outcome was there was no reductions in groundwater contaminant concentrations and the site redevelopment was delayed. So how many times do we have a developer that comes in and really wants us to move fast? And sometimes just taking a few extra steps to recharacterize, to better understand what the source area is, a better delineation on the plume, more information related to the hydraulic conductivity and radius of influence, some microbial studies, some treatability studies to assess various substrates and what the dosing would be for the site specific that you might require, and removal of the upgradient sources. So if you could post that poll, please. So as we can see, you know, it looks like the vast majority, 72% said that you had to go back out and redo your injections because of poor initial characterization. So I think, you know, the lessons learned here is that sometimes it's better to take a step back than just quickly going with the information that you know, and coming up with some additional data is very important. Next slide, please. So here's that case study. So just looking at it from a cost, if you remember the red and the blue lines on the graph, we're going to try to put this out in a little bit in terms of cost savings. So if we look at this one right here, we can see the cost has two columns and the years have two columns. So the cost is without going forward with the RDC, and the second column is with RDC. So you can sort of see that the next slide, please. That without the upfront RDC, you're still spending that $160,000 that you would have theoretically done before going out. That's part of this. Next slide. And you can see that the rework remedy is that if you would have spent that money upfront, and rather than having to go back out for a second time and do the remedy for another $200,000, additional groundwater sampling for another $170,000, and the RDC, obviously that would have been spent in either case, but you didn't spend it up front. So there was a net savings of $380,000. But more importantly, take a look at the last two columns. So you can see the last two columns that it took 8 years under the standard study, but with using the RDC up front and coming up with a better conceptual site model, you save 3 years. And on any redevelopment or any project, saving time is also saving money. And I think that's what this shows very nicely. Next slide, please. So again, one of these graphics, as Chris mentioned, we don't want you to read, but we do want you to take a look at the red circled items. These are headers of information that we have identified as being important in this overall document. Next slide. So we have the physical properties, flow properties, and aqueous geochemistry. Next slide. Microbial and degradation products. So each of these are in the text of the document as a table. But more importantly, if we look at the next slide on this table 2-2, you can see that we broke it up into a number of headers. So when we look at this, we can see that we have up on top the remediation phase, alternative screening, remedial design, and performance monitoring. We feel those were very important. What kind of approach are you looking at? Are we looking at a biotic or abiotic approach? And then we looked at, are they more applicable or less applicable or relative importance by the color code? So this gives you some guidance to look at when you're choosing your remedy at your site. Next slide, please. So you can see that as we look at the performance here, each of these has a relationship that we have, the color code and the in situ approach. But what makes this title, and as Chris noted, that these are all interactive. So if you click on the next button, please, we see Providence in Mineralogy, and click again, please. And so if you hover over that, these are all hover tables so that, you know, what pops up is a definition. So it tells you a little bit about each of the topics that you have, whether it's mineralogy or fractures or grain size. Next slide. We can see with the next slide that we go into stratigraphy. And again, giving a definition, we're looking at, you know, the geologic layering. EPA is looking at stratigraphic sequencing. So we're looking at those gravels, those sands, those six. So those complex interfingering, whether it's a bedding plane, whether it's a deltaic environment, whether they're complete or incomplete strata that go from one area to another that would influence the overall injection strategy. Next slide, please. Again, the same thing holds true in the flow properties. Next slide. Where we have heterogeneity as a hover box. So again, you know, we want to look at those to look at, you know, are we looking at a homogeneous isotropic formation? Or are we looking at one that's more, it has more heterogeneity to it and therefore more silts and clays and gravels that may be present? You know, these type of formations are going to be more complex in terms of how we're injecting and what our radius of influence is going to be. Next slide, please. Anisotropy, again, the same thing. It's the layering, how it's going to go, and especially true when we're doing injections. You know, how is this going to impact the direction of the amendment within the physical aquifer itself? Next slide, please. Aqueous geochemistry. Again, here you can see the same thing. If you hit the next slide, please. We can see sulfates. And again, sulfate is a very important aspect of things because a lot of times sulfate is an indicator as we're going through with our amendments that we're adding. And I know JD and Elizabeth will touch more on this in terms of as we add our amendments to the formation. Next slide. So here we have a poll question. So we've identified sulfate as, you know, as we're going through in a reducing environment. So the question is in your experience, has sulfate been beneficial or an inhibitor to your in-situ implementation? So again, it'd be interesting to see what everybody has on this. I'll give this a minute. But you can sort of see that if we're going out and we have a lot of sulfate already in an aquifer, what does that mean? Or if we go out and we find that we have very little sulfate in an aquifer. So if we could bring up the poll question, please. And the answer there was...
I'm going to just give it a few more seconds so we can get a little higher participation.
Okay, thank you. So again, if we look at the electron acceptors in products in order to of reaction, you know, this is sort of what we're looking at from an electron acceptor aspects to what we would expect in byproducts. So again, it's just the redox ladder. And we see that we're sort of split almost 50-50. There is some benefit that some people see for sulfate and an inhibitor. And I would agree with both because some tend to enhance. And obviously, you may have to overcome your sulfate in the formation in order to drive your reactions. Next slide, please. On the aqueous geochemistry, again, the same thing holds true here. Poll question coming up. In your experience, can chloride concentrations be effectively used as a line of evidence of reductive dechlorination? Next slide. I think we have a pop-up here while the people are answering the poll. So we have chloride. So again, if we look at chloride occurs, you know, naturally as a chloride ion, are released and the concentration of chloride may increase. You know, they're natural chlorides that may be present in groundwater. So there could be challenges. You know, take a look at a landfill or saltwater intrusion. You know, each of those are going to be an issue that you may have with remediation. Never mind, the chloride can be toxic to microbials. So does the poll answer, is there more yeses or more noes? And as I would expect, there are more yeses. So, again, people have found in your experience that it can be used as an effective line of evidence for remediation. Next, please. Again, you get the idea as we're going through these. Microbials, same thing. So next slide, please. So you hover over these and we see dissolved hydrocarbon gases. Again, these are very important, especially when you're injecting electron donors and we're going down to, let's say, we reach methanogenesis. The last thing we want to do is have a methane buildup underneath the building. So again, you want to look at dissolved gases as you're moving forward. You may end up having to monitor those the same as you would as natural gases coming off of something like a landfill. Next slide, please. So at this point, we're coming to our crossroads of questions and answers. I'm going to turn this back over to Devin so that we can answer your questions.
All right. Thank you, Rich. At this time, we'll begin our first Q&A portion of our training today. Excuse me. I would like to remind everybody that we do have CEUs available for this training. So if you are interested, I will put the link for that in the chat after the question and answer break. Feel free to sign up for those. That registration will close at 2:15, just as a heads up. So if you're interested in that, please do so sooner rather than later. As a reminder, again, we do have certificates of completion available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training today. We would love to hear from you guys on your thoughts about how the training went, and we would love for any other suggestions and so forth in the feedback form. So at this time, I will give a short pause and see if anything comes into the Q&A pod. If not, we can move on with the next segments of our training, but I'll wait here and see if anything comes up.
And Devin, as we're waiting for questions, I just want to have everybody, you know, be thoughtful in terms of, you know, this is the first program, as Chris was indicating. I'm not sure if we're the meat or tomatoes or the lettuce or the cheese. But as we move forward, this is the basis for what Jaydeep and Elizabeth are going to be talking about in terms of, you know, coming up with amendments and coming up with your design. Without having a good characterization, you can put all the amendments that you want in an aquifer and it may not be effective. So just bear that in mind.
Thanks, Rich. All right, we have a question here. Have you ever analyzed soil mineralogy to look for sulfide to evaluate natural enhancement of chemical reductive dechlorination?
Well, I think that is a really good question, where natural dechlorination by mineralogy is well known and can be used to evaluate. And I think it's one of those things that you need to evaluate in your site characterization model. Jaydeep, do you have any other comments that you may want to put in on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there are, see, always when you are presenting a case, you are looking for multiple lines of evidence. And when you are looking for multiple lines of evidence, this becomes one of the lines of evidence that may not be explained as clearly explained by some of the injections that you may have done. So I think that's certainly a line of evidence that can be used to support your remedy for the site.
All right. Thank you, Rich and JD. We'll pause for a few more minutes here and see if anything else comes in. If not, we can move on to our next segment.
And I guess looking at soil mineralogy and chemistry, I do have a site that's sort of unique where we had to do a lot of work in terms of understanding wire release of sulfuric acid, nitric acid, and chromic acid resulting in a pH of 9.5 in the aquifer. And after careful assessment of the site characterization, we've identified that that particular site is located in a delta environment, but was also located in a glacial delta environment that lake basically dried up and was resaturated on multiple occasions. And the clays that were deposited became desiccated or highly fractured. So the acids actually moved through the clays and were buffered, resulting in a high pH in the aquifer. And it became a exercise of explaining that to the regulatory agencies as to why it wasn't that we have bentonite in every single monitoring well that we had, and we had poor construction. We had to do work in order to explain that, you know, the clays were the driver of the pH. So again, as you're looking at your remedy, there's a lot of things in site characterization that you need to look at.
All right. So we have no more questions. Unless any of the trainers have anything else they want to say, we can move on to our next section with JD. Oh, excuse me. We do have one question that just came in. And while we're here, we might as well get to it. What are some options for injecting and administering amendment colonies into deep aquifers, 200 or 300 plus feet below the ground surface? It would be for VOCs.
And this is one of the items we will certainly cover as part of, you know, the design section that we'll just talk about next. And we kind of go through the elements of what is your amendment versus your dosing and the delivery strategy. So that's certainly, I think, what the question refers to, more of the delivery strategy for deeper aquifers. I know there are a number of tools available that you can certainly reference from our fact sheets and the information that's been included. Certainly, you're looking at, you know, deeper injections, so higher pressure requirements and so forth. And certainly from colony standpoint, you wanna make sure that you are keeping your amendment in the right condition so that your colonies don't die before they get to your target treatment zone. I think those are going to be the elements. Rich, do you have anything else to add, or Elizabeth or Chris?
I think JD, you've nailed it there. But I think one other thing is also understand the geochemistry. If you're trying to get colonies growing, you know, down to 200, 300 feet, you really need to clearly understand that geochemistry, because you need to sustain the biological that's going on. So again, having that up front with your RDC is critical.
And let me just add something. I like, when I do bioremediation, I like to think of my aquifer as you would a fish tank, just to kind of put it in a more colloquial terms. But, you know, if you're thinking about establishing a saltwater tank, what are you going to do? You're going to go buy the tank. You're going to set it up. You're going to make sure all of your geochemistry is correct. You're going to make sure your pH is right, and all of the other chemicals that are involved in sustaining your fish before you go buy expensive corals and fish and put it in your tank. Your aquifer is no different. So if your pH is, you know, pretty low in that deep zone, you need to get your pH up a little bit by pre-injecting with a carbonate or bicarbonate or sodium hydroxide or something like that, and get those conditions right before you start inoculating it with live bacteria. Otherwise, it's not going to survive. So you have to really pay a close attention to what you've got. And you may have a situation where bioremediation just simply isn't the appropriate technology because you have so much to overcome. There's more than just a pH issues. You might also have too much sulfate or some other parameter that is toxic to it that you can maybe overcome one, but you may not be able to overcome three issues. And selecting an alternative technology would probably win out in those cases.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth, JD, and Rich. We have one more question. What parameters would you look at in your CSM to predict contact time between contaminant and treatment, thinking about vadose zone treatments?
Well, I think if we look at the parameters, and we went over many of them in terms of your conceptual site model in the saturated zone, but when we're talking about the vadose zone, you know, we're looking at, you know, how you're going to inject in a vadose zone. Same thing, what is your potential radius of influence? Your contact time, you may need to do a pilot. And I think JD and Elizabeth will be talking about the merits of pilots. So I think you still have to think about the same things that we've already reviewed in the conceptual site model. But I think you have to look at it in the fact that you're not dealing with a saturated media. You're dealing with an unsaturated zone, and your layering may be important as well as how you are going to do the injection, which will be discussed.
Okay, thank you, Rich. It looks like we don't have any more questions. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to JD for his section. And just for all the attendees, we do have one more Q&A section at the end of the training. So feel free to put any questions in the pod at any time, and we will tee those up to be answered verbally.
Excellent. Thank you, David. Thanks. Great start by Chris and Rich over here, and this great one coming up after me from Elizabeth from the content standpoint. It is good to see participation from the attendees over here. So thank you for your questions, and we welcome more of those. I am Jaydeep Parekh with ERM. I'm going to be talking about design as the next key element of the optimization framework. So design is chapter or section 3 of the guidance document, and we'll go over some of the key topics over here. Our discussion will revolve around this key graphic that Chris touched on earlier. And design of an injection remedy involves three key components. One is selection of your amendment, the reagent or the mixture that will be injected, deriving appropriate dose for that amendment. And by dose, we mean how much at what concentration. And third is the delivery technique to effectively distribute the amendment in subsurface. We'll discuss this in this section, that these three components are interrelated and interdependent, and we call it collectively the design wheel. Through the RDC and remediation design process, you will be collecting data and making design decisions. For optimization, you would want to review the data in the context of these three components and their interconnection as you progress with the design. We recommend revisiting the design wheel throughout the process, from conceptual design to remedy implementation and performance monitoring. I'm going to use the arrows. The key concept that we are putting forward here is design is an iterative process. We'll discuss various design support elements, including bench and fill pilot testing, and how they contribute to refining the design in an incremental and iterative manner. See the graphic to the right here that Chris touched on as well earlier. You may start with the available design basis for the amendment, dose, and delivery, and you run some bench tests. At the end of the bench test, you review the data, improve the design, and determine what is an appropriate next step, which may be fill pilot testing. Your basis for the fill pilot testing will be informed by the bench data, and with fill pilot, you would be collecting additional data and review that to inform your design. At this point, you may have sufficient confidence in the data and the design basis to go forward with full scale. Conversely, I've seen situations where pilot tests were inadequate and you have to go back to either bench or pilot again and try out different parameters in different amendments. This overall graphic exemplifies the iterative process of optimizing the amendment, dose, and delivery design for an injection remedy. We'll work through this logic and processes as part of this presentation. The first consideration in the design process is the target treatment zone, or TTZ. This is the area and vertical interval in three dimensions that you are intending to remediate. In defining the TTZ, you would need to consider factors including expected performance of the remedy and any secondary effects due to injections, as well as costs. So I want to make sure I am going fine. Good. Okay. As you gather more information and work through the design process, you may revise the TTZ based on different considerations, for example, your cleanup objectives. For mass reduction or mass flux reduction type of objectives, depending on the level of treatment you see during the bench or pilot study, you may choose to target more discrete intervals with higher concentration or contaminant concentration or mass compared to a broader interval or a zone. If more than one remedy is planned, either adjacent to each other or sequentially, the target treatment zone for each remedy must consider how the remedies may interact with each other. For example, if you are planning an ISCO for a DNAPL source area and reductive dechlorination or ERD for the downgradient plume area, you would need to decide where you end the TTZ for the ISCO and where you start the TTZ for ERD. In this case, the TTZ for each remedy should consider the longevity and reactivity of the amendments and downgradient transport from ISCO to the ERD treatment zone. The TTZ must also consider the potential for unintended discharges to the amendment and any reaction byproducts. For example, if a surface water body is nearby, then a TTZ should consider the potential transport of amendments or the byproducts to this sensitive receptor. Equally important is to consider hydrogeological and geochemical characteristics as part of the TTZ determination. The guidance document talks more about these considerations and also provides several references to learn more. The key message we want to convey here is that TTZ may be revised and or refined as the design is developed. So what tools are available to support the design? There are a number of design support elements that can be leveraged throughout the design process. These elements are an extension of the CSM or RDC, as Rich covered. And if you recall from the RDC discussion by Rich earlier, the number one reason for failure is the lack of, actually, I think it was Chris who covered it, the lack of adequate characterization of TTC. The design support elements we'll be discussing are modeling and analytical tools, bench testing, and fill pilot testing. To demonstrate the design process, we've developed this hypothetical case study. At this site, we have fairly robust characterization. We have identified where the mass is located. We have a fairly good understanding of the geology and hydrogeology. The contaminants are chlorinated solvents, and the geology is sand and silt underlain by clay, as you can see in this graphic. You can also see the contaminant distribution. Orange denotes the highest concentrations, followed by yellow, and the green is the dissolved plume. You can see the groundwater table with the blue line, and most of the impacts are in the saturated zone. Now we are on to the remediation planning and design stage. First, we use desk-based analytical tools to support the remedial options analysis and feasibility study to meet the site-specific remedial objectives and goals. The feasibility study helped us narrow down to two technology, ISCO and bio, for our remedial goals. We will talk about this case study and discuss how we leverage different design support elements through the design process and optimize the three components, amendment, dose, and delivery. While we have the case study that will follow for this part of the presentation, we'll also take stops along the way and talk about key elements from the guidance document. First stop here is the modeling and analytical tools. These tools are typically used for parameter estimation, for example, degradation rates, groundwater flow and transport, and geochemical reactions. Table 3-1 of the guidance document provides a list of tools and their applications. These tools can range from a simple spreadsheet calculation to a complex 3D model. Selecting the right tool for your application, depending on the questions you're trying to answer through the design process. It's important to remember that the complexity of the model does not improve the outcome or the accuracy of the model. There are inherent uncertainties, and the model will be only as good as the input parameters that you use or assume. Some of the simple spreadsheet tools can often be quite useful and more applicable. Also, important to note is that some of the models are available in public domain, whereas others are commercially available for a fee. Bench testing is the design support element. Thinking about the design wheel of amendment, dose, and delivery, Once amendment is selected, bench tests are often conducted to understand the reactions and level of treatment and to develop an estimate of the dose. This serves as an initial screening level assessment or proof of concept for the remedy. Bench tests are often typically performed where treatment processes are a bit more complex, for example, potential for competing reactions or site conditions pose a level of uncertainty. In many cases, bench testing can offer useful insights to help develop design parameters. Bench tests are typically done using site-specific soil and groundwater to understand the reactions with the amendment and effectiveness of treatment. The picture here, the one to the bottom first, which is the batch or jar test. That's a type of bench test, and it generally simulates ideal contact conditions. The picture to the top here is a test of our columns and indicates column tests where you introduce, where you have column filled with soils or media from your site, and you introduce the amendments either at one of the ends of the soil column and monitor reactions at different distances within the column. Bench testing is a useful tool to predict reactions, estimate dosing, and it is a lower cost investment prior to field testing. To go from bench to the field, scale-up effects, including heterogeneity of field delivery, must be considered as you proceed with the design. A caution to note here is that field heterogeneity and its influence on amendment transport cannot be duplicated in the lab environment. Secondary effects are the unintended consequences of the injections. For example, we injected a bioamendment under an occupied building, as Rich noted earlier, that may have resulted in methane accumulation under the slab, creating hazardous conditions. Or we injected permanganate and a subsurface utility, a preferential pathway, took the purple permanganate solution 1,000 plus feet to a recreational water or a creek. Some of these secondary effects can be transient, lasting only hours to days, for example, groundwater mounding due to injections, and others can be persistent in subsurface for a much longer period of time, for example, redox and geochemistry changes in groundwater. Potential for secondary effects must be considered as part of the design. Bench testing may give you a good understanding of potential secondary effects and if any mitigation should be considered as part of the design. So, poll question here, Devin, if you can pop that up. Have you used bench tests in your design for an in-situ remedy? We can wait about 20, 30 seconds and close the poll. We have a second question as well that folks that already answered the first one can ponder on. That's good. A little bit higher percentage where people have used it. And oftentimes bench testing is used for technologies that are more sensitive to site conditions, right? So that's great. Let's go to the second one. If you've used bench testing in your design for your in-situ remedy, did the results change your approach? Let's see what the results say. Good. As 60 plus percent really had a change in approach because of the bench testings. That indicates that it was useful and served the purpose. Thank you for that. I have the control. Do I? No. Okay. Just switch the control there. Now let's come back to our case study and take it further. We collected soil and groundwater. So for this particular site, the hypothetical site again, we collected soil and groundwater from the site, ran bench tests, both for ISCO and bio. The results showed that ISCO reactions were faster and had more secondary effects. Importantly, the oxygen demand was relatively higher, resulting in higher cost for an ISCO remedy if we were to go full scale with that. The bio was slower but cheaper, and the site did not have any timeline pressures for remediation. Hence, we selected bio to move forward with field pilot testing, and selected amendment was emulsified vegetable oils, EVO. Also, the bench test provided a good guidance on the dosing requirements for the amendment. And here, a reference back to the guidance document is that sections 3.4 and 3.5 provide details of amendment selection and dosing. And Appendix A is a good source, good resource providing fact sheets of various types of amendments. All right. Let's pause on the field pilot study or a case study for a second and talk about the field pilot testing. So field pilot tests are typically small scale preliminary field injection events with a robust monitoring program performed at the site. This could also be the first phase of your phased implementation of the remedy. The emphasis here is on the robustness of the monitoring program to collect the data and improve the design. Field pilot tests are typically conducted, for example, to get a good handle on delivery strategy under site conditions, or understand amendment distribution in subsurface, assess for the secondary effects, or evaluate level of treatment in the real world conditions. The pilot study data feeds into the design wheel and helps refine parameters for full scale. As we discuss field injection, let's review how the amendments distribute during injections. This depiction is a cross-section view. The earth tone color represents various geological layers, with darker browns being lower permeability zones. Warmer colors present the area of contamination with the highest concentration identified by orange. The purple is the amendment injected at each location identified by the arrow, which are the injection locations. The graphic on the left shows the scenario with less geological heterogeneity, whereas graphic on the right shows greater geological heterogeneity. In the case of less heterogeneous geology, the amendment is distributing somewhat more uniformly, whereas for the more heterogeneous geology to the right there, results show substantial variability in lateral influences versus the vertical interval. And you can see those stingers of purple going out from the injection points. This brings us to the third key component of the design wheel, delivery or the injection strategy. The goal of the delivery is to distribute the amendment more evenly within the TTZ. The physical properties of amendment and the media that we are trying to inject into, which is our subsurface, dictate how the amendment gets distributed. More soluble and less viscous the amendment, more easily it will inject and distribute in subsurface. Higher permeability geologies allow easier injection with the highest radius of influence. In other words, injections will be easier in sandy geology compared to clays. And heterogeneous geology with clay layers back diffusing contaminants into sandy layers adds to the complexity of designing a remedial strategy. Pressure allows you to push the amendments into subsurface beyond the injection points. If you're trying to inject a slurry, for example, ZVI, the particle size of the amendments may be larger than the pore throat of typical geology. And therefore, you may need high pressure delivery techniques or fracturing like hydraulic or pneumatic. Conversely, if you are injecting a dissolve amendment, you can gravity feed the solution into sandy geology or use pressure to propagate the solution farther beyond the injection point. So here we show table 3-4 of the guidance document, which is the delivery method screening matrix. I think there are some animation over here. Here the columns show six different delivery methods, and our rows show a list of geologies that influence the applicability of this delivery methods. And the individual cells in the table contain one of three terms which on the applicability of the particular delivery method for those geologies, either widely used, site-specific, or not applicable. To use this table, select the geology that best fits your site-specific target zone, and you can compare applicability of various delivery methods. Also, the column headers are hyperlinked to the fact sheets for those delivery methods, and each fact sheet discusses the advantages and limitations as well as typical injection equipment. Now let's come back to our case study. We completed our bench testing and decided to move forward with pilot testing using emulsified vegetable oil, EVO. Based on the design wheel, we developed our injection or pilot testing work plan and got necessary approvals. We injected the amendments and conducted the monitorings. The monitoring data showed that the sandy and sand and silt layer, we got good distribution of EVO. Our dosing was also appropriate, and we got useful data for our full-scale design. However, in the clay layer, we saw short-circuiting and very poor distribution resulting in poor treatment. This told us that we had to rethink the amendment and amendment dose delivery nexus for the clay interval treatment. So here a poll question, a couple of those. Have you used pilot tests in your design for in situ remedy? And I would probably think that some of the folks have use probably more pilot testing than the bench testing, but let's see if we get that result. There we go. A lot more pilot testing is used, and that's great news. So wonderful. The next question, please. If you've used the pilot study in your design for the in situ remedy, did the result change or outcome of the pilot study change your design? Typically results in some level of refinement, but sometimes we've seen that you would end up changing the entire approach as well. Very nice. That's also very high percentage, and that indicates that how useful your pilot testing was for the overall success of the site and the management of the site from remediation standpoint. Thank you. Can close that. Very nice. So coming back to the case study, we went forward with the full-scale design for the sand silt layer using the data from the pilot test. And then for the clay geology, electrokinetics was a different delivery approach that again, hypothetical case study that we went forward with. Now, given that it was a new approach, we wanted to go back and evaluate that from the bench study standpoint. So EK uses low-level direct current to distribute amendments in low permeability matrix. You can distribute electron donors like EVO, electron acceptors, and microorganisms using this method. right. Thank you, Dylan. So we went back to the bench testing for EK. We set up a reactor with the site soil and groundwater. We put in the electrode and the direct current over there. We added the amendment and started the DC current and started monitoring the transport of the amendment over time. As you can see from in the graph to the right over here, we started seeing amendment distribution at different sampling port over time. And this gave us a sufficient basis to develop our field delivery technique. And next step we proposed was the field pilot testing. Thank you. We took the information from bench testing, set up our test cells in the field, and ran the EK pilot study. The spacing was spacing for the injection as well as the electrodes was informed by our bench testing results. And the data from the test showed that we can use EK to distribute amendment in the clay layer. The field pilot testing helped us refine our design parameters, including spacing of the electrodes and expectations on the time frame for distribution. Using the pilot data, we updated the design parameters, implemented a full-scale amendment delivery using EK, and of course, conducted monitoring along the way to make sure that MED was progressing as designed. So this is it for the case study for the design. I hope this helps you see the use of different design support elements and that it is an iterative improvement, an iterative process that results in an effective design and remedy implementation. Now we'll switch the gears a little bit. And we'll cover some of the guidance document elements that are also key as it pertains to this particular section. One of the ones that we want to draw your attention to here over the next couple of slides is on amendment delivery and persistence in subsurface. The graphic here shows typical injection patterns in plan view, commonly used for delivery. The dots in the middle of each circle are the injection points. The small arrows denote amendment distribution. The circles indicate the radius of influence or ROI, and the colors indicate the amendments. The grid pattern, which is the first one to the left, is where you have injection points on general equal spacing across your injection area or TTZ. Your ROI typically is overlapping and you are going for the distribution across the entire area. This technique is more broadly applicable for targeting source areas. Some find it advantageous to start the injection on the perimeter of the TTZ before moving into the interior portions to limit contaminants from migrating or getting pushed outwards. The inject and drift approach is the next graphic there, which leverages distribution of amendment with natural groundwater flow. This may be applicable in situations where geology is less heterogeneous, the amendment is soluble, and groundwater velocities are relatively high, and or amendment is relatively persistent and would move with groundwater. Recirculation is using a set of wells where you are injecting in one well or multiple wells and extracting from certain number of downradiant wells. This strategy can reduce the risk of amendment migrating beyond the treatment area and increase the contact time. This technique is also often used when you're looking to target impacts in groundwater, which may get pushed away when you inject liquid amendments or if there is a sensitive receptor nearby. The last graphic is the barrier. That is a linear transect, and you are injecting to intercept contaminated groundwater as it flows through the treatment, the transect. The next set of graphics here show amendment behavior and persistence in subsurface. The processes affecting amendment distribution include advection as a result of pressurized delivery, how far you push out the amendment from your injection points. Advection and dispersion due to natural groundwater flow, how fast the groundwater will move the amendment along with it. Diffusion as a result of concentration gradient, and reactivity or persistence of the amendment in subsurface, how fast it will get used up in subsurface. This graphic conceptually shows the differences between effects of groundwater velocity and persistence of the amendment. So in conclusion, for this design section, the key messages are, design is iterative in nature. It is an iterative process. Use the design support elements to improve and inform your design basis, from modeling to bench testing to field pilot testing. Review the data from the support elements to improve your design as you go along. And review the nexus of amendment, dose, and delivery throughout the process, from conceptual design to remedy implementation and performance monitoring. This concludes the remedial design sections of the presentation, and I'll hand the control over to Elizabeth to take us through the next section. Thank you.
Thank you, JD. Oops. My apologies. I have hit the wrong button.
It looks like you took control, Elizabeth, if you want to just try moving your mouse around.
I minimized it. Now I can't find it. That is my problem. Oh, shoot. There we go. Okay. I'm so sorry. Now, let me try to. And now I'm not seeing the control buttons.
Looks like you have control, but it doesn't seem to be advancing. There you go.
Okay. There we go. I'll just use this, the spinning wheel on this. I'm so sorry. Okay, so on with it though. So today I'm going to talk about the implementation monitoring and how to interpret the data that you've collected throughout this process. First of all, we've already heard about we've already started the project by your remedial investigation, your site investigation. You've collected a bunch of data so far through which you have delineated your plume, and you've collected that data. And then we've talked about today your remedial design characterization data. So there are a couple other different types of monitoring that we have to consider as we're implementing our remedy, whatever that may be. And section 4 will talk about the major categories of remedies, such as anaerobic bioremediation, aerobic bioremediation, ISCO, flushing, solvent flushing, all of these different type of possibilities. And the process monitoring that you might want to consider for each one of those major categories. Your frequency and parameters are going to vary depending on the amendment and the type of remedial strategy you have in place, keeping in mind that some remedies happen very quickly, such as ISCO, and other remedies, such as a lot of the bioremediation type scenarios, those may take several years to get started and then to complete. So the first thing we want to talk about is, how do we set up that well network? Some sites may require very down gradient wells that you will use to determine whether or not you've got a receptor, that sensitive receptor, if your plume is migrating that way. Other scenarios will have monitoring wells that are in your source area and within your target treatment zone. And a lot of your process monitoring is going to be happening right there within your target treatment zone. If I were to classify these as qualitative versus quantitative data, I would say your process monitoring is more qualitative. You've got a lot going on during the process, and so it would be qualitative. Quantitative will be your baseline monitoring and your compliance monitoring. Your compliance monitoring may simply be, depending on your regulator and your site-specific conditions and the type of remedy you're implementing, may be something as simple as only your constituents of concern. And it may be a very small number of constituents. For a more complex site, depending on what you're doing, it may also include secondary water quality parameters. Say ISCO, a lot of times you have a lot of chromium issues and arsenic issues come up with a lot of different remedies. And that may also be included in your compliance monitoring. And just to kind of step back a minute on baseline monitoring, if you have done a pilot study at your site, since you established, you know, what you thought was your baseline, you really need to go back and do another baseline sampling before initiating your full scale. And I would encourage you to include background monitoring. So select an upgradient well so you know what the conditions are upgradient. There's a lot of value in that, whether it's seasonal fluctuations in a lot of the geochemistry, or is, you know, your site being continuously impacted by an upgradient property. We don't know all of these things yet. So section four includes a number of tables that explain the various parameters that you might be looking at to assess whether or not your site is progressing as you want. And so this right here, I don't expect you to read it. I just expect you to go back to the guidance document and really study these tables. So this is table 4-2, which with regard to anaerobic biostimulation, and 4.4, which is chemical oxidation. And you'll see that they have a lot of things in common, you know, in the parameters, the contaminant concentrations. For ISCO, of course, your contaminant concentration is going to be pretty simple. Whatever your parent concentration is, it typically doesn't have a lot of byproducts, and it just, you see a downward trend. For bioremediation, that gets a lot more complicated, and you also have to concern yourself with the breakdown contaminants. And there's some interesting nuggets in here about where it says interpretation guidelines. And it encourages you here to use the molar amounts when you're doing your trend plot so that you can actually see what your total constituents of concern are in relation to the molar amounts of your various, your parent product and your daughter products, to see if you really are having reductive dechlorination occur, or are you simply other processes of attenuation occurring. And so that's a good trick to figure that out. Ultimate end products. Again, on this ISCO side, those products may dissipate very quickly, particularly once they are in the data set. When you get to bioremediation, the end products like methane, there's some nuggets in here, like the, that's supposed to be getting bigger. There we go. If the sulfate reduction and methane are not observed in an anaerobic biostimulation project and your ORP is greater than negative 120, the conditions aren't right for sulfate reduction. So you've got to really pay attention to all of the data as one body. So you may end up having some very, some of these indicator parameters may be positive, that they're showing that they should have the right conditions. But read through this very carefully and make sure that you have all of the conditions that are necessary. Another thing that trips people up with regard to ORP is methanogenesis really occurs between negative 200 millivolts and negative 400 millivolts. I can't tell you how many times I've seen somebody write that their ORP was negative 50, and therefore we're good to go. Dehalococcoides is happy, it's doing its job. Those microorganisms that are responsible for complete degradation of TCE without stall really need a ORP, I'd say minimum negative 150 at the, and that's stretching it. The literature says negative 200, negative 400. So keep that in mind. If you have got a project that's not working, can you rectify that by adding more carbon, more carbohydrates? Typically, that's the response to that, and that typically will solve your problem. So there are lots of recommendations in these tables, regardless of whether you're talking about bioremediation, ISCO, aerobic bioremediation. So take a look at those tables closely. And if you find something in there that you know you're not matching up with what the recommendations are for what that particular parameter is, you need to take a look at whether or not your site can be optimized. Or should you just, is it time to, you know, cut bait and select an alternate remedy? The guidance in there can also suggest whether or not, you know, are you ready to go M&A? There are plenty of cases where we start M&A a little too quickly, in my opinion. If you start to really run the financials on the project, you might find that another injection will actually save you, you know, 5 or 10 years of M&A, and it may actually be cheaper in the long run to continue with your active remedy, but just a wee bit longer. And as I say that, let me also remind you, another thing that I see when I do peer review is that a lot of times people do one injection of a long-lasting carbohydrate, especially like EVO, and they think it's a one-and-done event. And typically that's not the case with bioremediation or with ISCO, because a lot of other processes happen, and one of those being desorption. So you may get a case in ISCO where, you know, you've dissolved or you've tackled your main problem in your dissolved phase, but in doing so, lots of other things become desorbed from the soils and are now put into the dissolved phase. And you may be scratching your head going, what's going on? Why did my concentrations actually go up when this should have taken care of it, or it did in my bench scale, it took care of it. Why did it not here? And it could be a simple matter of you have desorbed a lot of mass from your soil, which is one of the steps in the process. If you don't desorb it from the soil, you will continue to have these equilibrium states that a lot of people refer to as rebound, but really what it is, it's a new equilibrium of the sorb phase of contaminants on the soil going back into the dissolve phase, and you seem to have this never-ending cycle. So it's important that that desorption occurs, whether it's by through you know, oxidizing ISCO or reducing, or even the biosurfactant properties of a lot of the microorganisms in the bioremediation projects. So keep that in mind. Another thing is, going back to the tables, look at them. Have you actually collected all the data you need to evaluate the progress? It may be that you need to you know, take another look at your sampling and analysis plan and say, could we benefit from having this data? And a lot of times I see that people have added things in to their plan later, like sulfate and sulfide, but unfortunately they didn't take a baseline sample, so they don't know if it's gone down or not. They don't know if their sulfate has reduced into sulfide. So that's an important part of the process, because you're not looking for a magic number here. You're looking to see those changes. And if you didn't take the baseline data, there's really not a heck of a lot of point in adding that later on. So make sure that you've collected both the correct baseline data as well as your process monitoring data. And you need to think about that. Do the what ifs when you're planning your plan. You know, we think we know what's going on here, but, you know, you never really know. You can never really have enough information. On the same note, I would say if you know that all your sulfate has turned to sulfide and now there's no reason to continue to pay a lot of money, you know, lab fees and collect samples for something that you already know the answer to that question. So make sure it's flexible and that you can stop collecting analysis when the time is right. Another thing we want to talk about is in what way is your remedy underperforming? So we've got tables in section four that will kind of walk you through the process of, well, is it because I have a distribution problem, or do I have a geochemical problem, or, you know, why is my amendment not getting to the area where I need the treatment to occur? And, you know, that can occur for a lot of different reasons. And everything is site dependent and site specific. So there's not any one easy answer to that. But you will find in this guidance documents a lot of recommendations towards, you know, well, what is my problem? And I'm going to give you an example. We're going to walk through a case study here in a minute where we did exactly that. And we'll talk about which design criteria that we identified was wrong and determined that we could optimize it in the case of this particular case study we're going to do. Sometimes you just need a supplemental remedy, and the case study we're going to talk about also has a supplemental remedy. Sometimes the supplement can also be as simple as adjusting your pH. Sometimes it's a whole new delivery mechanism, as in the case that we're going to talk about here. So this case study is the total area of the site itself is 380 acres. It was in an area of town that was undergoing redevelopment. It used to be a textile plant. The plume itself was 12 acres, and that includes about four acres off-site and 8 acres on-site. The geology is a Piedmont, which is a heterogeneous saprolite overlaying weathered rock and schist. The contaminants of concern were primarily carbon tetrachloride. There was about 4 milligrams per liter of carbon tet and some TCE, and of course the daughter products that go with that. And it had had a pump and treat system that was running for 13 years. There was a little bit of hydraulic control offered by that system, but essentially they installed this system very much like they did a lot of systems in the 80s, which was shallow wells near the source area. And as you moved out, they got deeper to protect the streams and the everything. And the wells actually produced less than a half a gallon a minute. So it wasn't a tremendous amount of hydraulic control. And the concentrations really, if anything, they were dragging, the system was dragging the contaminant lower and not really doing a whole lot of cleanup. So we did a feasibility study and walked through, you know, all the various different alternatives and decided that this site was best suited for an anaerobic in situ bioremediation. So we're going to step through what we did here, but we optimized this bioremedy by really evaluating the data on a monthly basis. This is a brownfield site undergoing a lot of pressure from the developers to get this done in about 2 years, which for a 12-acre plume is pretty darn aggressive. So we needed to anticipate the changes in the groundwater chemistry as early as possible to keep this, keep all the little optimizations going, so we didn't fall backwards and fall into that hole of gosh, scratching your head, going, gosh, I don't know what's going on. One of the ways we did that was by, on a monthly basis, even early on, we started every 2 weeks, sending somebody out in the field with a multimeter on a long enough cable that they could just drop it in the key monitoring wells and give me a pH, DO, ORP, and those three basic field parameters that are so easy to collect and basically very, very inexpensive, gave us the information we needed to know as to whether or not we were progressing in the right direction or if we needed to make a change. We're going to talk about how we did have to make some changes and we incorporated hydraulic fracturing to improve the distribution. This did have a bedrock issue. We relied on the natural downward vertical gradient to help get some of that bioremediation down in the bedrock. We had a contingency plan to install additional wells in the bedrock. We got lucky on this one and we did not have to do it. We have a sister site to this one, owned by the same corporation. The site was located about 15 miles away from this site. You'll hear me talk about it as a sister site throughout, because we learned a lot of lessons learned on making some assumptions about sites that were so similar. So you can learn from my mistakes. I'm okay with that. I can admit that I made some mistakes before, but anyway, we did not in this case have to treat the bedrock. We anticipated monitor natural attenuation once those groundwater impacts were addressed in the shallow. But you'll see when we're finished with the project, we got this thing cleaned up remarkably fast through constant optimization and looking at the data and interpreting it on a very, very frequent basis. We did not wait until the annual report or the semi-annual report to do that. So what did we do? We installed 134 injection wells in a target treatment zone. It's about 4 acres. Those wells are on 25-foot centers in a pattern such as you see here. You'll see in cross-section, these wells were installed to the top of the transition zone. And so the screen length is whatever that happens to be. So they varied. Some wells had as little as 10 feet of screen in them. So other wells had 30 feet of screen. If I were to do this over again, I would not exceed a screen length of about 15 feet for injections, just because it provides you with more control over your vertical when you're injecting. But we were very successful with 30-foot screens here nonetheless. And we had an automated injection system. So this automated injection system, what it did is it allowed us to, let me back up just a minute. So this is the array. These are the wells. You'll notice this black lateral that goes right down the middle, called the injection header. And then the greens are the laterals going to each one of the wells. This injection header is about 350 feet long. This is an above grade pipe. And we set it up this way because this injection header actually runs in the trough. So if you go back to the cross section, you'll see that there is a bedrock trough here. And the concentrations, as we installed the wells, we collected data from about 5 to 10% of the wells. And we were able to track it, and we discovered that the highest concentrations were down here at the bottom of the trough, and they petered out as you got higher, which makes sense. And then we were able to eliminate a few wells on this side over here, which is the southwest side, and then on the northeast side, we found that we actually needed to go a little bit further. So the overall size of the system didn't change. But due to that bedrock trough and how the concentrations were laid out, changed the way exactly how we put in the system. So collecting additional characterization data as you're doing the install and writing a plan that allows you with that flexibility to install it how you want to and how you need to based on your current in the field information will give you a much better product than simply going out there and not testing it. And later finding out you just installed 30 wells in a clean zone. And that's money that could be spent much different ways. So this header right here again is about 350 feet long. The automated system, you could set this up. It had a PLC in it. So we were injecting 10 gallons per foot of screen. So if a 10-foot screen, that's 100 gallons of injectate. It was a 10% carbohydrate solution. And all of that could be programmed in and changed as much as we wanted to. So it took about 30 hours for it to inject in each and every one of these wells. It could inject into multiple wells at a time, and it took about 30 hours for it to inject in all wells. And then it started back over in the beginning. So multiple injections, this is a very soluble carbohydrate, unlike an EVO. So it doesn't last as long. But at the same time, we could get more material into the ground. So within 6 months, you know, back to the field parameters, we were collecting those. We saw, we were watching our pH, because a lot of times when you do inject a lot of carbohydrates, there are a lot of volatile fatty acids that are formed, and that acid will drop your pH to a zone that could be, not very beneficial for your microbes. So even though they're creating it, they also, you know, create these acids in the pH drop. So you got to watch that. The ORP was exactly where we wanted it to be in the source area. So our redox conditions look well. But here we see in the blue is a carbon tet. It's got this nice downward trend. Meanwhile, the daughter product, carbon chloroform, it goes up, followed by the methane and the methylene chloride. We see both of those. And then you'll eventually see the methylene chloride and the chloroform also starting to drop off. So excellent 6-month trend. Notice this says in the source area. So here's what it looked like after 6 months. So we have cleaned up our source area, but dadgummit, we still have like 300 to 500 micrograms per liter on the down gradient end. And that wasn't much of a change. We didn't see a tremendous downgrade, decreasing trend on the down gradient side. So that's, I think, probably the first project I'd ever had where I cleaned up the higher concentrations in the source area first. So noodling through that a little bit. Is there a question here at this point? I guess not.
I think it's in a slide or two, Elizabeth. I can check.
Okay, I'll just hang on. Okay, so here's what we saw, an increase in the daughter products. The pH drops slightly it dropped a little bit after 6 months. It says 12 there. We saw the increase in the methane concentrations. We had ideal redox conditions for biodegradation, but they were not uniformly generated across the plume. And the distal end of the plume really had no change. So we're going to go take a look again back at our cycle. We've implemented, we've monitored, now it's time to optimize, and what are we going to do? So here's a chart of what the redox evaluation looks like. So what do I mean by redox conditions? That's methanogenic. That ORP is like negative 200 to negative 400 up here in the source area. But as we really look at it, we're seeing aerobic conditions on the distal end of the plume. And you're not going to have reductive dechlorination in an aerobic environment. So we're scratching our heads as to, well, why did that happen? So given the data that's just been presented, what type of problem do you think we have? And what do we need to do to optimize it for success? Would that be, is it a delivery problem, a dose problem, an amendment problem, or all of the above? So while you're thinking about it, the amendment, we'll start with that. We see that the amendment actually worked in the source area. So there's really no reason to believe that the amendment is not effective. Can we improve upon it though? Perhaps, remember I said that the pH had dropped slightly. So maybe we do need to work on that. See that most of you do say all of the above. I think there's a little bit of that. And delivery, I would say delivery was our number one issue on this particular project. We do adjust the dose. We will adjust the amendment. But delivery is the primary problem. But all of the above is the correct answer. So optimization number one. Downgraded anaerobic conditions are not established. Our COC concentrations and our pH are stable in this area. So that tells me if my pH stays stable and my constituents of concern, those concentrations are relatively stable. We are probably not getting the amendment to the problem. We're not putting the two in contact with each other. Degradation byproducts are not being observed. The other thing is that, this is also telling us that we're not flushing it out either. It's not being pushed out. It's not being terribly diluted. So what is going on? The ROIs in the downgradient wells appear to be less than what we observed in the source area monitoring wells. So, what are we going to do? We're going to revisit the remedial design characterization and the design wheel, and we're going to see, how do we increase the radius of influence in the downgradient well, and why is that a problem in the first place? So, let me go. This right here, remember I said this line here was 350 feet. In a 2-inch line, that equals 60 gallons. And then you also have these laterals that go out to the individual wells, and then you've got the depth of the well itself. So when you start adding all that up, you've got about 70 gallons that is just under nothing but gravity feed. And by contrast, these wells up here that are closer to the source area, they're actually being injected to under pressure. So when you've got that fluid being injected under pressure, you're going to have a larger radius of influence. So here's what we're going to do to solve our problem. First of all, for the amendment, we're going to address the pH drop. So it was just a little drop. We could have added a sodium bicarbonate or sodium carbonate or sodium hydroxide or any of those types of buffers to increase the pH, but the pH drop wasn't that bad. What we figured, 10% is pretty high carbon load. We got great, it provided ideal food for the microorganisms. So we decided, we can get away with 5% if we increase the entire volume from 10 gallons per foot to 25 gallons per foot. So now a 10-foot screen, instead of getting 100 gallons, is going to get 250 gallons, but we're dropping down the carbon load to 5%. So we really haven't made too much of a change at all, other than we're going to add in a flushing dose, some clean water flush those amendments down into the well itself. And that is going to allow us to increase the radius of influence. We also had a little fermentation issue in the summertime, and that helped with the clean water flush. So the fermentation issue in the holding tank, since we did so well at the upgradient side, we decided we would run this instead of continuously every 14 days. And initially when we did that in the hot summer months, what was left in that holding tank would froth up, bubble up due to fermentation, and then spill out all in our equipment building and made a mess. So we added a stir in the holding tank. So all these things that we designed for in the process. So after we optimized it, we realized that we still had this one little tricky area here. We got this northeastern part of the plume. It cleaned up nicely with all of those optimizations, but we still have this one little area here where the carbon tet, it's lower in concentration, but it's not doing what we want it to do. It's still, even with those changes, and you see how close it is to that lateral, it should be getting all of the amendments under pressure. So what is happening to the amendments now? What does that tell us? So poll question, what do you think it's telling us here? So again, the amendment, even with optimization one, it was effective in reducing our concentrations to below MCLs. So we can eliminate amendment. The dose that seemed to certainly help to increase it, will increasing it further help? Or do we need to evaluate other delivery methods? And the right answer on this one, I think, is pretty much delivery. So go going back to our remedial design characterization, looking at the logs and really studying the logs, and this is a case I'll tell you where we, back to the sister site, we actually did not take boring logs for every single well at the sister site because we thought we knew enough about this region and that it was homogeneous and, well, not homogeneous, but, you know, we understood the heterogeneity and how that really, how to really work within the heterogeneities that were there. This site, we noticed that there was a lot of silt and clay lenses in this one particular area on the sister site. We missed a lot of those clay layers that were up in the Vado zone. And what we did not realize there was, you know, the significance of those clay zones and how much material was caught up in them. So we've got this low permeability zone mixed in with our sands and clay. So probably what's happening is our amendment is going the path of least resistant, which is going to be into the sandy or gravels and those type of materials. And it's going to short circuit the clay and the silt where a lot of the adsorption has occurred. So we've got to come up with some ideas of how will we address this? How will we get our amendments to these tighter zones? And so one of the things we were talking about, this is one of the earlier years of hydraulic fracturing. This project was actually done in implemented in 2001 to 2003. So it's almost a 20-year program, 20-year-old program. So we had Clemson University was nearby and they had a lot of graduate students that were working on their master's degree. And we had invited them to come help us out with this project. And so we sponsored a number of master's level students on some work. And they implemented the hydraulic fracturing. So we started with a pilot test. So here's a case where we have gone through this whole process and we are down here in the full scale and we're going to back it all the way up to the pilot test phase again. And a lot of people are afraid to do that. We think of CERCLA as being a very, you know, marching forward type program. But sometimes it's good just to drop back and test some things. And we didn't want to invest too much in this because it was a new technology. We didn't want to do it full scale without first testing it. So that's exactly what we did. So we wanted to evaluate if we could enhance the distribution by creating these additional layers. So what we did is we took a direct push tool and we injected it. We drove it down about 40 feet below the ground surface. And we injected a fracture, and that's done with the food grade guar and sand. So we're injecting a proppant, whereas these days we inject a lot of things like the ZVI or the amendments themselves. But in this case, we did sand as a proppant. And then we installed these piezometers at various depths because what we wanted to evaluate was this. What is the thickness of when we inject through that proppant, how will it react both in a vertical direction as well as in a horizontal direction? So we did the vertical first. So this is what our experiment looked like. We injected and then we saw where it went and we saw that we observed it about, we had trolls in each one of these wells and we saw that it was about 3 to 4 feet both above and below the fracture you know, the fracture itself allowed our zone of influence to increase vertical. So we also did it on the horizontal. So that system looks like this. We injected 5 fractures total. And beginning at 25 feet below the ground surface, which is about 10 feet below the water table. We also kept it 7 feet off of the transition zone because that transition zone is very permeable and we're trying to really focus on these clay and silt lenses and we didn't want all of our amendment to go into that transition zone. So we installed piezometers on a 20-foot and a 40-foot interval. Here you can see it from a bird's eye view at 20 feet and 40 feet and then we injected into that. And what we learned from that was that our zone of influence or radius of influence was somewhere greater than 40 feet. So we implemented this full scale. So we've got 11 stacked fractures. In some cases where the when we get further away from the bedrock trough, there might be three fractures. And along the bedrock trough, there were five fractures stacked on top of each other, just as shown. Hooked it up to the automated injection system and started it up. So we let that run. It took about 9 months to actually complete that pilot study and get the those fracture sets installed and hooked up into the system. So during that 9 month period that we were operating that pilot study, we simultaneously were running a rebound study just to make sure that nothing was coming back in the areas where MCLs had already been met. And what we learned was that back diffusion was not occurring in those source areas and up gradient and to the northeast. That wasn't occurring, that back diffusion was limited to those high clay content areas that we noticed in our boring logs. So the radius of influence for each fracture, we estimated at 45 feet, 11 fracture sets on 75 foot centers. Automated system, we injected once a month now. So we did change our delivery pattern. We kept it at about 25 gallons. Actually, I think we increased it to about 100 gallons per foot for this one. And we ran it for a total of 6 months. We observed that reductive dechlorination very quickly. The TOC concentrations, we finally saw those coming up to ideal levels in our monitoring wells after just two injection events. And then we transitioned this site to M&A in 9 months. So, and here's a look at what the redox conditions look like. And down gradient, we see that finally we're getting methanogenesis. Again, that's ORP of negative 200 or worse, or lower. And we see that aerobic conditions are starting to show up in the source area. So things are coming, returning back to normal and everything. So wrapping this up, just the transition to M&A, the key question is know when to stop. Early on, you know, I talked a little bit about sometimes it's cheaper just to do a couple more injection events than it is if your M&A is going to end up lasting, you know, 10 years, depending on what your program is. So know when to stop, know when to transition to another technology. I'm working on a project right now that was a bioremediation site. And after looking at the data and the conditions that were there, the geology in particular, it was a more of a fractured sandstone site where when we installed our first well, it was actually dry. Reductive dechlorination, no biological process works particularly well in an unsaturated environment. And, you know, the fracture zones just don't provide enough of an environment for the bugs to grow. And that was the limiting criteria on that site. We actually switched that to dual phase extraction. So it's, you know, totally, we're not injecting anything at that site. We're just extracting air and water. So it's not always appropriate to inject something at a site. And you may find as you are evaluating your data that your process is exactly that, your site may not be conducive to an injection strategy to begin with. You do reach a point of diminishing returns. I've got a site right now where the remedial action objective is to reduce the vinyl chloride down to below 1 microgram per liter, and it's currently at 3. And I've never been asked to remediate 3 micrograms per liter of vinyl chloride before. And it's a little harder than you might think. And it was originally a bioremediation site. One of the things you need to consider as well is that when your concentrations of chlorinated solvents in a bio site are below about 50 micrograms per liter, those bugs are going to die off. And it's going to be really hard to keep them going because the food source of choice, which is, you know, TCE or vinyl chloride or whatever it may be, it's not there for them. And in a lot of cases, a site that you did not originally have to bio-augment, you now have to. And one of the things I would warn you about is this site right here. We did not have to bio-augment it at all. The bugs were already there. So we were very lucky there. We didn't even test for the bugs on this site. We did no microbial analysis at all because we had all of the indications that it was there. So it's not always required that you do that. If you don't have the evidence, or if you have the infamous DCE stall, it's a good idea to do that. Another thing I would caution you against is if you see concentrations dropping below around 50 micrograms per liter, don't think that your site's just going to, you know, just naturally attenuate, because a lot of the bugs die off when the concentrations get that low, and it may go even slower than you anticipate. It's better just to keep it going and keep a strong colony of microorganisms going all the way straight to the end, instead of allowing that to taper off. Your regulatory framework, of course, is going to decide a lot on what you do about M&A. Some states have different guidelines for M&A. Some are more liberal, some are very conservative. So just keep that in mind. And your final site use. So this site in particular was a brownfield site. Originally, it was an industrial property that was going to, it actually had deed restrictions that it must remain industrial. But the only buyer for it at the time wanted to build apartments. So that's a more stringent criteria for cleanup in this particular state. And my client agreed to meet those residential criteria because it was cheaper than holding onto the property, quite frankly. So that's exactly what we did. And in the final stages, because this particular client had been caught by surprise on emerging contaminants at some other sites, they expected the developer to develop it with vapor barriers in mind, just in case a new emerging contaminant should be, come to light in years to come. They were very conservative when it came to the health of people, and required those vapor barriers to be built in the foundations of the apartments. And my company was able to assist them with that too. So all told, I've worked on this project for 25 years for different phases of the project, all the way down to the vapor barriers on it. So just a quick recap, I know we're running out of time, but so this was a example where we only treated 4 acres of a 12 acre plume, and we were able to achieve MCLs throughout the entire plume. Natural attenuation at the remaining 8 acres, the bedrock also did. And so great success story. So all in all, there were 4 cycles of optimization in this story, including the pump and treat. One thing I should keep in mind, you should always keep in mind as you're planning it, keep a contingency plan for everything. We had that contingency plan for the bedrock and we implemented it. We did not have to implement it, but we did have it in our back pocket. So if you would like to, make sure that you keep your project moving quickly, then have those contingency plans in mind and write a very flexible decision document, work plan, and work with your regulator so that you can see through, see this through in a logical manner. So again, section 4, I talked a lot about anaerobic biostimulation, but the same process is in the document for aerobic biostimulation, ISCO, ISCR, surfactant flushing. You'll see lots of really good fact sheets, tips and tricks and such on how to interpret your data and help you decide whether you're have an amendment dose or delivery problem, and suggestions for how to fix that. Sample frequency, let's see, I'm trying to wrap up here real quickly. Dependent upon site conditions and the amendment chosen, remember that an ISCO monitoring is going to be very, very different from bioremediation, and have a contingency plan. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Chris to wrap us up.
All right. Thanks, Elizabeth. And that we as regulators need this document too, so we don't fall into the old ways of the linear thinking. We need to get the next slide there, Devin. Thank you. And that's another benefit of presenting an optimization document via the web and ITRC, is basically to expose the states to this iterative and interactive way of thinking and design. As you can see from this graphic, EPA recognized the need for adaptive management style for their Superfund projects. This figure
Chris, it looks like you cut out. All right, Chris, I see your video's back on.
Yeah. Yep, right. I just lost connection.
All right, I can hear you well now.
Okay. So next slide. No sound, Rich? Yeah, no, I mean, it shows me as unmuted. So can you still hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, good. So even though the remedial activities may occur in situ, meaning underground, or on private property, the activities are noticed by people living and working in the surrounding communities. They want to know how this activity may affect their lives. So we need to have honest and upfront communications to alleviate their fear of the unknown. And it may also reveal the potential consequences that we may not have previously thought of. So it's important to develop a media communication plan and identifying a single point of contact. We need to anticipate the questions in advance and develop a fact sheet or maybe a list of frequently asked questions. Next slide. All right, so as you can tell from Elizabeth's presentation, JD, Rich, we want you to use this document. Use it like your toolbox, because it provides a framework for optimization and includes a number of tools for your reference. Use the table in Appendix B for your table of contents. Make sure your CSM is complete by referring to Table 2.2 that Rich got into at length, and dive into the fact sheets. Click on the hot links. As stated in my introduction, we want to use this to make predictable and optimized outcomes for in-situ remedies using sound science and engineering. I think you've really gotten a good handle on that from our presenters today. As soon as we end this webinar, I want you to go to the guidance document on the web and upload the Appendix F checklist to begin using everything you've learned here for your site. All right, Devin. Let's get to questions.
All right. Thank you, Chris. So with this, we're going to head right into our last Q&A portion of the training today. Our first question is statistical analyses and trend determination based on monitoring data are important to estimate time required to clean up a site. Is there any other method or methods that can be used to determine the required time for a cleanup?
I know that the document does have a whole section on modeling statistics. All of that information is in the document and covered. We just didn't talk about it a lot today. But yes, you're right. We do use a lot of statistical trend analyses to do this. There's also modeling, mod flow and those type of things can be a predictive that are a little more involved than just simply doing a Mankind alert, some of these other types of methods. But those are the primary ones. JD, do you have anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, no, same thing, right? I mean, those are some of these are very, very proven sort of, methods of analyzing data in making adjustments and seeing how the technology is progressing. And Elizabeth, in your presentation, you kind of worked through a number of those different elements. And I think what you really want to think about is how, I think while we look at the dissecting whether it was a delivery issue versus amendment issue versus dose issue, ultimately we are looking at multiple data points, right? And whether it's the contaminant, the COC data that you're looking at, or some of the geochemistry data, or some of the amendment specific data, depending on the time horizon that you have on those data points, you can employ a number of different methods to really evaluate how conditions are changing over time. Right. So those are going to be dependent on your data set and how you would want to, the type of questions you want to answer using those analysis.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth and JD. I'll read the next question. Reductive dechlorination of carbon tetrachloride is very rare, even following biostimulation. More rare is even the full dechlorination all the way to methane. Was the biology investigated for that site? And was this previously investigated in treatability lab studies?
So the answer to that is yes, that we did do a more focused pilot study at the very beginning of the project. Like I said, I worked on this one for 25 years. I could talk about it for days on end, but we did do a pilot study that did not, as I mentioned, really do a lot of microbial analysis because the pilot study initially did show that it did go all the way to methane. We also had TCE in there in the mix as well. I talked a little less about that because there's just too much to talk about. But the methane can also be generated not solely from the carbon tet, but from the carbon and the microbial processes that are going on there as well. So that's one of the problems with methane. It is an indicator dissolved gas, but it is not solely limited to, being produced by the degradation process of that particular chemical. It can come from other sources. So you got to keep that in mind. I've not really heard before that it's rare to degrade carbon tet. I've done it on several sites, so that's news to me.
All right, is that it, Elizabeth?
That's it.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. I'll move on to the next question. At what point do you switch from calling the work a pilot study versus a full-scale implementation? The case study seems to be full scale based on the pilot study working across the full site to allow M&A.
Well, let me start off, and I think, Elizabeth, you can end up. I think this is an excellent question of a pilot study versus full scale. The pilot study you may want to look at, if you remember, we talked about in the remedial design characterization. So you may want to do a pilot to learn information in terms of radius of influence, injection strategies, back pressures, pump selection, a number of different things. And then if it's a small area, your pilot may actually be the long-term solution if you're working at the pilot and it's, in a very small area. But a lot of times the pilots are a small scale portion of a larger plume. And I think more specifically, Elizabeth, you can talk to the case study that you presented.
Yeah, so, we implemented, we consider that a full-scale implementation of the ERD, and then we jumped to a pilot for the hydraulic fracturing. And then when we installed the 11 different fracture sets, we could call that a full-scale implementation. I don't know that it's important so much to say where pilot study begins and pilot study ends. I've worked on several projects where, because things are going faster than the regulatory process, a lot of times we say we're doing a pilot study because we want to get it done and we'll do it at risk before getting your proposed plan and record of decision solidified. And so by the time we get to that decision document, we may have a very different type of decision document than we might have had before the pilot study. The decision document may be M&A at this point, whereas because the pilot study got us far enough that we could do that. So I don't know that it's really all that important to say I'm out of the pilot study phase and into implementation.
Right. If I can,
unless there's a regulatory reason for it.
Right. And no, Elizabeth, right on, right? So there may be a regulatory reason, but I think if you go back to the presentation that we had, we spoke about this design section, right? The idea is that during pilot study, you are collecting good amount, you have a robust monitoring program and you are collecting good amount of data to actually continue to refine your remedy, right? The amendment dose and delivery side of things. So it's really, how much more data do you need or continue to need to really call it a pilot? And then you can transition over to, okay, now I know what's happening. Now I know what works, right? And now I can reduce my monitoring frequency and save some money. So that's sort of the typical transition that you can kind of think about. But again, I mean, there are multiple factors, as both Rich and Elizabeth noted. Sometimes, you're trying to just look at what is your, injection back pressures for the pump selection versus you're trying to look at, am I really getting the reduction that I need in the contaminant concentrations, right? So there are those multitude of things that you can consider and really think about, where you would call still your study versus pilot study versus where you call your full-scale implementation.
All right. Thank you, trainers, for answering those questions. And special thank you to our participants today. We appreciate you taking your time out of your busy schedules to join us. Just a reminder, I did put it in the chat. ITRC does archive all of our courses. So if you have any extra time or are interested in any additional topics or classes, please look on Fluent's archive training page for our whole catalog of training courses. So with that, I will wish you all a wonderful rest of your day. And thank you again for attending our training course. And we look forward to hopefully seeing you in a few other training courses this fall. Thank you, trainers, for being with us today. And I will talk to you all later.
Thank you.